You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 58 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
You said that like you weren't sure.
I forgot which year it was. The fact that it was 58 and then 48 threw me a little bit.
It is hot here in Seattle, and I am fired up. I am so excited to get to this beer right away.
Are you?
And I'm ready to get into this.
I'm ready to get into the pod, but I'm surprised you're excited at all about the beer.
I just want to get the beer over with.
Yes. We have here the Pyramid Triangulate Citrus Pale Ale, a beer that is literally not listed on the Pyramid website. I went and looked. It is not there.
Wow, an off-the-menu beer.
Yes, it is. I thought this was emblematic of the fact that, so we've never talked really about Pyramid. Probably we did on the original incarnation of the Peltoncast, but not since we came back. Because for a while there, it was like the Seattle beer company.
It's like an introductory beer.
Especially the Pyramid half.
It's like, I talk about this a lot, right? Where to our parents, craft brew meant Red Hook to them, right?
Yes.
And it was like Red Hook and Pyramid, and they had a couple of options, and it was their major beers, and then there's craft beer, right?
Which I don't think they drank at all.
No, definitely not.
I mean, to their credit, they were drinking a staggering amount of Rainier.
And then Pyramid was kind of the bridge for them, not for our parents, but for people from that time period, right? Pyramid was like, oh, this is a little bit better than Red Hook, maybe. It was the Hefeweizen was a new beer to a lot of people.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden it exploded, and Pyramid is just kind of a maybe replacement level or below replacement level beer.
Yeah, they got left in the dust a little bit. So now they're trying to really branch out and brew a lot of different things. And I got to say, I don't think I've tried almost any of them.
Well, here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
We can say that we're celebrating the Mariners and their extended streak here by drinking a beer that is on Royal Brumway.
Although we are not drinking Pyramid Curveball, which is the more natural beer to drink to celebrate the Mariners. That's the only Pyramid I think I've had so far in 2017. I'm not sure if we go back to 2016, how many you would add to that. Should we talk a little bit about the beer that I had on my trip to the Bay Area last weekend?
Absolutely, we should.
All right, so one of my goals over the weekend was to hit up to get something from Drake's Brewing.
Okay. Drake's Brewing now?
Yeah. Man, he's so prolific.
That guy does everything.
Drake's...
Who did he steal brewing from?
Well, Drake's located in San Leandro, California.
Okay.
Which is somewhere in that area.
Sounds lovely.
Not sure where it is. Anyways, the reason I've been thinking about it is because of the fact that Guilfoyle has been drinking Drake's lately, and there's bumper sticker for it on the show Silicon Valley.
Wait, you noticed this?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very prominent. In addition to his usual Old Rasputin.
Yeah, I saw that this week he was drinking Old Rasputin.
Yes, and he was low on it and needed to order more. Thanks. Shout out to the refrigerator.
Shouts to the refrigerator. Okay.
So I had a Drake's IPA on Saturday night after the basketball analogy live show, which we'll get to in a second here. That was pretty good. Also had an IPA from Fort Point, which is an even smaller. None of these are that I had.
Is Drake's considered a good brewery in San Francisco?
I think so.
Frisco is what.
No. So pretty much everything I went with was is stuff that's not available in the state of Washington or really.
I mean, that's what you should
be doing.
With one
exception outside of California. Well, I mean, you know, it'd be cool if you could get something if you could get the IPA, but you're able to get a deeper cut.
Okay.
In the local area. I had an Altamont Maui Wowie Tropical IPA. That was pretty good. Fort Point Brewing, which I actually went through Fort Point. There's a old military installation there right near the Golden Gate Bridge, underneath the Golden Gate Bridge that we walked through on Sunday morning.
Okay.
And had an IPA from them that was also quite good. I really enjoyed everything I had this weekend, and a blonde from Federation Brewing. So.
Okay.
But the highlight of the trip was on the last night, finally finding Pliny the Elder.
Really?
Yeah.
Where did you find that at?
We went to this kind of trendy restaurant that Nate Duncan suggested.
Okay.
It was called In-N-Out. No. called Nopa. And they had Pliny there and was like very casual about having it there. So that's the amazing thing about the Bay Area. It's just like
very casual. Yeah. I mean, what beer would they be? A bunch of stars drawn around it on the menu or something.
Yeah.
They were like, I'd look at this. Pliny. Did it taste better in Northern California?
Well, it's weird. I had it on draft when I went down there in the fall. I didn't enjoy it as much. I thought it was just kind of fine. But this time it really hit the spot.
Some good Pliny.
Yeah.
All right, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy you found it. Can we toast with these pyramid brews?
What are we toasting to specifically here?
To Drake.
All right, to Drake and his brewing company, his brewing endeavors. The man is so busy.
Not great.
Did we say that this was a citrus pale ale? Did we actually say what this beer was?
Pyramid triangulate citrus pale ale.
Yeah, I don't think we ever said what it is.
It's not great. That's what it is. Do you want to talk more about your trip to the Bay Area, or the Yay Area, as I like to call it?
Definitely. So I got in Thursday afternoon, flew in day of games. It's a relatively short flight. On my trip from the airport to the hotel on BART, stopped off and went into La Taqueria.
Okay.
To get a burrito.
Is this a sneak?
No. bringing a backpack and a duffel bag into an extremely crowded La Taqueria, even at, I think it was like 2 p.m. on a Thursday. Not a sneak. not something I recommend. It appeared that you could order to, like, call in a to-go order. So really? That would have been a sneak if I had known about it ahead of time.
Basically, your main sneak is just calling in orders.
Because people don't think to do it. I mean, the key to the sneak is not just the to-go order. The key to the sneak is finding someplace nearby to go and eat it.
Yes. Did you know that I'm staying on the 4th of July weekend? I'm going to Portland, staying in an Airbnb, which is like a 5-minute drive from Pok Pok.
I did not know anything about this.
So the sneak is going back to the Airbnb and eating it.
Yeah. That's a good sneak. So went to the game that night.
How was La Taqueria?
It wasn't as good as the last time because the fact that I waited to eat
nothing
it.
Nothing was as good as the last time.
Wait, no, I said Pliny was better than
okay,
the last
Pliny
time.
Was better.
Nothing was the same. Shout out to Drake. I had to take it back to my hotel and check in, and it took an extremely long time to check in.
So you didn't sit there and eat it at the restaurant?
No, I mean, there wasn't much space. And again, I had two bags with me. Like, I felt like such...
You were wearing a suit with the most purple outfit underneath?
I was sadly not wearing a suit at that point, but I felt like just the biggest asshole the entire time. But damn it, I was getting my La Taqueria.
Okay.
Went to the game, was wearing all purple there, much to everyone's delight. It was fairly uneventful game one, I would say.
They were both uneventful. How close could you see Rihanna?
No, I couldn't see her at all.
You weren't actually at the game.
No, I mean, I'm like all the stuff that you guys were like commenting on, people were commenting on off the TV broadcast, like in arena really wasn't evident at all. Maybe, you know, where other people were sitting because they were on like the main media seats are on the sideline opposite where she was sitting. But like we were on the baseline, on the far baseline. So like as far from Rihanna as you could be and still be in the lower bowl.
Okay.
So we didn't see any of that. But I did see Marshawn Lynch pass by at one point.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I heard Gary Payton was at game, at least game two.
Really?
Did not see him. Did see the guy in the Gary Payton jersey t-shirt directly behind the ABC broadcast.
The Sonics one?
Yeah.
Nice.
In the front row, directly behind the broadcast.
You saw Marshawn Lynch walk right in front of you?
No, I mean, he was also at court level, but I actually, he just happened to
you could
pass
see him.
By.
It's not like he was in front. You couldn't have talked to Marshawn Lynch.
No.
Okay.
No. That opportunity was not there.
Okay.
He wouldn't, I mean, I'm a member of the media. He wouldn't have talked to me anyway.
Although that's a good point. Maybe he would now.
He did do an interview today at Raiders.
I'm a
OTAs.
Member of the media. He wouldn't have talked to me anyway.
I mean, seriously. So Friday morning played.
Next time you see Marshawn Lynch, though, invite him onto the podcast.
Okay.
From as far away as you are.
Hey, Marshawn! So Friday morning played pickup basketball with a group that included Nate Duncan, Zach Harper of the Basketball Analogy podcast, Dave McMenamin of ESPN, Anthony Slater, who is one of the Warriors beat writers, and a couple of other media members. So it was a good time. And then afterwards, Nate Duncan and I went to my favorite spot in the Bay Area, Burma Superstar in Oakland, and were met by Danny LaRue, also of the Dunked On podcast.
Oh, wow. It was you and Dunked On?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a Dunked On special.
What is this, a crossover episode?
I know. If it were recorded, it would. Well, wait till I tell you about the crossover episode later. But
I'm excited.
That still remains my number one meal in the Bay Area by far.
Okay.
I love that place. It may be my favorite restaurant in the world.
Really? So Burma Superstar, just as good.
We did, yes, just as good. We did debate, Nate Duncan and I, in Portland when we were at Pock Pock, which was better, Pock Pock or Burma Superstar. And I leaned Pock Pock that night. But I was wrong.
Not even close.
Superstar's better.
Okay.
I mean, it's close.
were you debating on behalf of Pock Pock?
Yes.
And he was arguing pro Burma Superstar. Yes.
We were both going for
it
a
was
local.
It was kind of territorial.
Yeah. I would say that Pock Pock is like the Cavs against the Eastern Conference, and Burma Superstar versus Pock Pock is like the Warriors against the Cavs. That's my analogy. That's okay. My basketball analogy.
Okay.
That was pretty much all of note on Friday. Saturday was this live podcast for the basketball analogy, which was a really incredible experience. It was amazing that so many people turned out for the first live event that we've done. It was in this cool place in Oakland called Soul Space, which sells like shoes and other apparel. And then they had temporarily like a display of Warriors themed art on the walls.
Okay, I think I saw that in the photos.
Yeah, it was a lot of really cool pieces.
And it was all Steven Jackson, right?
Yes.
Okay,
every single one. There was a couple of Monte Ellis too. So this show was supposed to start at 7. We had to push it back to 8 so that we could try to like fit more chairs in to get as many people in as possible. The line, you know, went down the block from where Soul Space in front of Soul Space. Then it wrapped around an entire block the perpendicular to that, and then partway wrapped onto the next side of the block opposite.
Okay, you're really just gloating at this point, but okay.
I am. No, 100%. But it was an awesome experience.
They were all there to see Amin.
Yeah, I mean, I was low on the pecking order. I make no secret of that, but it was just incredible to have so many people show up. Have everyone laugh at all the jokes and know all the jokes from the podcast. Seth Curry showed up.
He was there for you.
He was not there. He may have left by the time I went up. So it was an awesome experience. And you know what it made me think?
What did it make you think? It
made me think we need to do a PeltonCast Live show.
PeltonCast Live?
I'm not saying that we're going to have people lining up around the block for no. PeltonCast Live.
I would be happy if we had 5 people there.
That would be a solid number. But it would be a
given
really
that we only
experience.
Have one listener. I mean, that would be exponential.
I mean, I think we could guilt some of our friends and family into coming.
I'm counting us as 2 of the 5 people. So.
Oh, good.
we won't be able to get all of my family.
We're already 40% of the way there. I don't know if you'd want to bring the kids. Marcus Thompson, who was one of the special guests, who recently wrote Golden, the miraculous rise of Stephen Curry. He brought his daughter, and by the end of the night, she was sleeping on her mom's lap.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I can tell you that my children will not be sleeping.
Oh, yeah.
No concerns about that.
If I know anything about the time we have to record this podcast, those children do not sleep.
Yeah, it makes me think maybe, I don't know if people would be interested in a live PeltonCast, but maybe sometime before the NFL season.
That seems like a good time for it. Gives us some time to build up another listener. So afterwards,
let us know if that's something that you might be interested in.
Yeah. Afterwards, everyone went across the street and hung out for hours until the bar closed across the street. So it was just really a phenomenal experience and amazing. So thankful to all the fans who showed up and waited in this long line for an hour longer than they expected. Some of whom didn't get in. Like, that's so much appreciation for that.
I like the idea of hanging out at the bar until the bar closes a lot better than the live event.
Yes. You could have pulled the Nate Duncan, which was Nate Duncan just went to the bar. He was like, I don't want to deprive anyone who's an actual listener of a seat. But we did have the podcast Singularity at one point after the show, which was Trey Kirby of the Starters.
Is this the crossover episode that you're talking
about? Yes.
About? Okay.
Who was one of the guests. Trey Kirby of the Starters, Nate, and then like several of us from the basketball analogy.
All of you.
All in one spot at the same time.
Wow. And Danny LaRue wasn't there?
Danny was at there was a comedy festival in San Francisco that was headlined by like Jerry Seinfeld, Bill Burr, and one other, Hannibal Buress was definitely involved. I'm not sure if he was a headliner, but he was at that.
Okay.
So he had a good excuse.
Okay. So then game two happens, also uneventful.
Yep.
But I have a question for you.
Okay.
So you have a streak of going to NBA Finals games that haven't been close, right?
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that streak, but it ended. Oh, game seven was close.
Oh, because you were at game seven.
Yeah, that was the first close NBA Finals game I had ever attended. So this
What is the amount of points?
I mean, that game was decided by like four points.
Not that one, but aside from game seven.
You know, I'd have to look it up on Twitter. I think I tweeted about it last year. But
so this goes to a portion of the podcast where you just read your tweets.
Yes. It's actually the mean tweets portion, weirdly. I don't know.
So anyway, how many items are okay to have in a checkout line?
anyway. Look, I think I want you to weigh in on that. This dates all the way back to 1996, though.
Yes.
When I attended game three of the Sonics-Bulls series, which the Bulls won by approximately 5 million points.
Yes.
And in a story I don't believe I've ever told on the podcast, our mom lost the tickets to that game the day of. And considered filing a police report to mark them as missing, which was the only way you could get replacement tickets. I told her not to do that because I thought that was a bad idea to create a false police report. She finally finds the tickets a little before halftime. We arrive at halftime. The Sonics are already down 25 at that
point. Game was over by the time you arrived.
It was completely over.
I I remember this story. How old were you at the time? You were 14. This was in the days when you needed the physical tickets to do anything.
Yeah.
Right? You couldn't just pull up your phone and get into an NBA Finals game. And they were in some sort of book that she had.
Yeah.
And she's praying to St. Francis or whomever.
The patron saint of lost items.
Only our mom would be aware of who the patron saint of lost items is.
Yes.
But she's praying. I think St. Francis might be animals or something. But one
of those multiple saints. Things, though.
So she's praying to St. Francis for this time period. And these are like insanely expensive tickets for 1996.
Yeah.
They're like $100 for our $8 season tickets.
Yep.
And then you show up and the game is over by the time you show up.
Yeah.
And you're presumably listening to it in the Cadillac driving down there.
Probably. And at that point I had attended. So that year, every single home regular season game I went to, the Sonics won. That, I believe they went 39-2 at home that year.
Lost two games during the regular season.
And you were at both of those games, right?
Uh-huh. The Knicks and the Pacers.
Yeah. And then during the playoffs, the only games I went to, I don't think I went to any in the first two rounds. And then the Jazz in game five of the Western Conference Finals, the Sonics lost with a chance to close out that series and go to the NBA Finals.
They were undefeated when I was at games in the playoffs.
So I gave you the... I was supposed to, and based on our order, go to game five of the NBA Finals. I gave you my ticket because of the fact that I considered myself bad luck.
You're welcome, City of Seattle. Yeah, you're welcome, Sonics.
And the Sonics won that game.
It would have been a five-game series if you wouldn't have done that.
If only you would have attended game six in Chicago. Maybe the Sonics would have made it, pushed it to seven. The final of that game was 108-86. So the next time I went to the finals was not until 2013, my first year at ESPN. And that time I went to games 3-5 in San Antonio under the mat, where it was 2-3-2. And those three games were decided by, let's see here, the first was decided by 36 points.
Oh my God.
The second was decided by 16. And the third was the closest game I had ever, finals game I had attended to that point. It was a 10-point game.
Okay.
So I had never seen a single-digit game until
game seven. Last year. And then that continued this year with two more blowouts.
Yeah. Because last year, the games in the Bay Area that I attended were 15 in game five, and then, alas, the four-point game in game seven. So, yeah.
Yeah, you're Adam Silver's worst nightmare.
Very much so.
Any other thoughts on your trip to the Bay?
I think that was pretty much it. The other place I went back to was there's a food truck called Señor Sisig that makes Filipino-style marinated meat burritos.
Okay, yeah, that's a thing that I'd like.
Yeah.
I've been on that.
I mean, it's not as good as La Taqueria and El Farolito, but for a place that you don't have to wait a half hour in line on during the weekends, or probably an hour, I can't imagine what it's like on a Saturday or a Sunday.
For burritos, that's insane.
Pretty good. Yeah. So check that out if you happen to find one of those near you.
I'm excited for when I go to Portland because I haven't really done the nice Portland food thing.
I assume you're going without your children?
No, they're coming.
Okay.
But we have this Airbnb, so all their allergies won't matter. Because I can just get... Can you get screen door to go?
I don't know. I don't think so. Okay. Maybe.
Anyway, we're going to have an extensive Portland food conversation. That might be when we do the Nate Duncan Portland food podcast.
I didn't bring it up to him, but I'm sure he's excited to do it.
Okay.
He's planning a trip to Seattle.
Oh, really?
And so I told him we have to go to Loretta's. He would love to eat a meal with you as well as me.
Specifically with me. And also you.
I mean, we were taken for granted that I was there, but he specifically called out that he wanted you to be there as well. So
I would love to eat Loretta's with Nate Duncan. Yeah, we might need to record that.
Yo, a live Loretta's pod. I love it.
When is he coming to Seattle?
I think August.
Okay, I can't wait.
So,
I'll mark my calendar.
Yep.
I'll cancel everything.
Just the entire month of August. Clear it out now. Take it all off.
So speaking of burgers.
Yes.
This week.
Great segue.
We went to, thank you. You know, segues are better when you compliment them live.
Yeah, you got to call it out.
This week, we went to Lunchbox Laboratory to the South Lake Union location. What were your initial thoughts?
So I feel like this was an extraordinarily difficult place for me to rate. Because like, when I break the burger down into its components, I'm not sure the components were all that great, or at least ideal, and it feels a little gimmicky what they're doing there.
Okay.
But yet, it was still a delicious burger and a good experience overall.
Okay.
You said you had a take, you said whatever you thought about them based on reading the menu, you still felt going out. What was that?
Okay. So the burgers that we got, we ended up getting two burgers, and we split them right down the middle.
Yeah, which is a good call.
One being their attempt at a Big Mac, basically. Yes. The other being their attempt at a Dix Deluxe.
Well, not an attempt at. I mean, it's...
An homage to.
Yes. If you look, I read the website a little bit more detail later this afternoon. They say, like, they understand it's not actually like the Dix Deluxe. It's just like some of the things that the guy who founded Lunchbox Laboratory liked about the Dix Deluxe and translated it to a more, you know, fancier style of burger. More
My
of a
hot
restaurant
take
style
is,
burger.
Why don't I just eat those burgers? Why am I paying... How much does a Dix Deluxe cost? $3? Why am I paying $15 for a burger that's an homage to a $3 burger?
Because it was a better version of it.
It really wasn't! If you put in front of me a Dix Deluxe and a Big Mac and said you could have these or you could have those other two burgers, 100% of the time, I'm taking the Deluxe and the Big Mac.
Well, I think that take is too hot.
It's not even close! I would not even consider the lunch. And it honestly, it's not bad. I'm not saying that the Lunchbox Laboratory burgers are bad. I thought they were pretty fine, right? But also, if you're factoring in the cost of it, it's like, say, $7 for a Big Mac and a Dix Deluxe, or $15 for one of those burgers, I could get four burgers for the price of one. I'm taking those four burgers.
Yeah, I got to probably deduct a couple of points off my rating for the price. It is really expensive.
It's insanely expensive.
But it's much more justified, I would
what
say.
What is this laboratory that they have where they look at other burgers and just try to recreate them? That's not that impressive of a laboratory.
I would say it's, I mean, like, is compared in this class to 8 Ounce Burger Bar or even to, what's the one Freelard that I always forget the name of?
Giddy Up.
Yep. I would say it was clearly better than those. Clearly a better use of the money than those.
Really? Than 8 Ounce? I mean...
So I didn't like 8 Ounce. It's my lowest rated burger.
That's insane.
Not saying that much.
Okay, so 8 Ounce Burger Bar is an attempt at a fancier burger, right?
Yes.
They're having much higher quality ingredients.
A gourmet.
These are basically just average ingredients. Maybe the beef is a little bit better.
That.
Okay, these are...
I thought the bacon was really good. Did you not agree with that?
The bacon didn't really stand out to me.
And the cheese was perfectly melted.
Everything about it was pretty good. I'm not saying it was bad, but it wasn't a gourmet burger. It's not a $15 burger. 8 Ounce Burger Bar is a gourmet burger.
Now, the $15 in this case does include your fries. Like, they automatically give you sides. So that has to be factored in a little bit.
It was an upcharge for cheese fries.
Yes.
$2 extra for cheese fries.
That was your choice. You knew that going in.
I didn't know that going in.
Oh, I knew that going in. I read the menu.
I found the menu confusing. I thought I was ordering a Big Mac.
You didn't even order one that's technically the Big Mac. You just ordered like the slightly different version of it.
It's the original Mac. Whatever Big Mac has that now. McDonald's has that now.
It's the classic American.
But it's basically a Big Mac. It had Big Mac sauce on it. But and the McDonald's sauce is better.
I would agree with that. I didn't think the secret sauce was that strong. But the cheese was perfectly melted. Did I say that already?
Yeah, you did.
All right.
I mean, I thought the burger tasted pretty good. I would probably, the burger patty, I would take that over a Dick's burger patty or a Big Mac burger patty. But the rest of it left me wanting more.
I mean, I guess my complaint, which would be related to the price, is just, I don't know why this is a sit-down restaurant and why not a takeout counter.
Like, come on. I could not believe how many people were there.
I mean, it's a very popular restaurant.
It's shocking to me. You know, that many people are paying $15 for burgers?
I mean, first off, 8-Ounce Burger Bar is quite crowded, and so
but
people.
But these are gourmet burgers.
They're not. They're not good. I would take this burger over 8-Ounce any day.
Well, we're gonna have to agree to disagree about this. You're kind of making me like 8-Ounce a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm talking to you into 8-Ounce.
I'm like I have to add a couple more points to my 8-Ounce grade.
I mean, I think the experience, like City Outside and everything was good.
Why can't I order at a counter, though?
I agree with that.
It's like you want to be a burger place. It's a sit-down restaurant. For the love of God.
You know what's weird is I'm pretty sure I went to Lunchbox Laboratory when it was in Ballard, and I don't remember it being anything like this. I assume it must have been like this, but I remember like the appeal being like, oh, you can order so many different toppings. Huh. Was like the selling point back then. They still have to build your own, but...
I went to the Bellevue location maybe 6 years ago, and it was more of like a diner type feel, which this may have been inside. Maybe it was more expensive. I mean, they're in very fancy locations.
That is certainly true.
Like, they're catering to Amazon employees. You know, they're not catering to Billions Corporation employees over there.
I suppose, yeah.
I guess maybe they are catering to ESPN employees, but...
Yeah. Is Little Woody's being right down the street from you, is it catering
yes,
to Billions
yes,
employees?
Yes,
okay. Okay, what was your final rating here?
An 88.
After all that, we had the same rating?
It was good, but like my rating of a Dick's Deluxe is pretty high.
Okay, I mean, maybe, yeah. I guess they should not have put anything about Dick's in there because it reminded you of how great Dick's is.
I don't know. Maybe it should be a little bit lower. Maybe I don't know. I'm trying to judge it just on the burgers itself and not on the price necessarily.
I mean, definitely factoring
in the price. Would I go back to Lunchbox Laboratory? Probably not.
I would go back. I enjoyed it.
The experience that I had burger-wise this week was I went to the zoo on Saturday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And after the zoo, maybe
you know,
Sunday?
You know, I heard there's a lot of people.
Where?
There.
At the zoo?
Yeah, it was a real zoo over there.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to let that one sit for a second.
I'll be here all week. I mean, I won't be. To her house.
Anyway, I went to the zoo, which is like a block away from the original Red Mill. And the thing about it was I was craving a Red Mill burger. I mean, I desperately wanted to go to Red Mill after. I ended up not being able to. But it was so close to Red Mill, and I just needed that burger, which is not something that I feel about. I would never feel it about Lunchbox Laboratory. I honestly don't feel about Little Woody's. There's never really a time where I'm like, I am craving this burger. But I'm right by that zoo, and I wanted a Red Mill burger so badly. Which is why I feel like we need to do, at the end, these grades are great and all, but we need to do a head-to-head bracket.
I agree with that.
Because we need to narrow it down to 8 burgers. Do we need an elite 8 of burgers?
I think 8 is a good number.
Okay.
I don't know how we're going to do the different rounds, but that could be a lot of time for doing it.
I think we should do it in two episodes. And maybe if we do a live show, do the final, crown the burger champion at the live show. And we'll need a third Pelton brother for that event.
So who's going to be the third Pelton brother this time?
I don't know. We'll see. Maybe Gary Payton. Marshawn Lynch, if you talk to him.
I was noty at one point, like one of the big questions in this NBA Finals is should the Cavaliers be playing Kevin or Tristan at center? Those being Kevin Love and Tristan Thompson. So we haven't discussed in a while the fact that the Cavaliers front court has the same names as we
really,
do.
Really not that much more to discuss beyond
well,
that.
Well, it used to be the joke was that Timofey was the adopted third Pelton brother.
I don't think I've ever heard this joke.
I made it to a Cavs employees, I'm pretty sure. But now that they don't have him, it's either got to be Channing is the third Pelton brother,
okay,
or LeBron.
Where did Mozgov go?
He went to the Lakers.
Oh.
Yeah. It was one of the worst contracts of a summer of bad contracts.
I'm gonna say in Pelton brother fashion, it's probably Channing Frye.
Yeah, Channing Frye feels like he'd fit in well here. He's got podcast experience.
Yeah.
So
maybe he'll eat burgers with us.
Yeah. All right, should we talk about the many recent developments?
I'm very excited to talk about
on
this.
The Sonics arena front.
Let's hear about
the Seattle arena front. The main one of those being that on Sunday, Seattle partners, the AEG group, withdrew from the process of bidding to renovate Key Arena and really went out scorching the earth with their letter. All right, let me quote. Here's the letter signed by AEG Facilities President Bob Newman and Hudson Pacific Properties Chief Investment Officer Alex Vuvuzelides.
It's pronounced Vuvuzela.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
We fear the city is driving toward an unrealistic financing structure, and we believe the city has failed to conduct a sufficiently thorough, objective, and transparent process to properly evaluate the respective strengths and weaknesses of the two proposals, and most significantly, to identify the proposal best positioned to develop a project consistent with the community's interests. And also, in explaining their decision to pull out, said that significant factors throughout the bidding through the bidding process have eroded our confidence in the ultimate execution of this project, no matter which group is selected.
Okay.
So here's what I would like to say to Seattle partners.
Oh, wow.
Get the fuck out of here. You submitted a proposal that literally did not meet the requirements set out in the request for proposals. If I may read to you from the requirements that are on the City of Seattle website regarding the Key Arena reservation. It's number one. It's right there, number one. It's not even number two. It's number one. Under the development agreement, the selected proposer will be responsible for 100% of the funding to be provided to complete the redevelopment and construction of the project, including assurances for covering cost overruns. 100%. You know who didn't submit a proposal that was responsible for 100% of funding? The Seattle partners who asked for $200 million in the city's bonding capacity. The audacity to submit a proposal that is on its face ineligible and then complain about the process? Like, I can't even imagine that.
They were only $200 million off.
I mean, it's... I'm flabbergasted.
You really are flabbergasted.
Like, I have some questions about the Oakview Group proposal as well, but at least it meets the requirements.
What do you think was in it for the Seattle Partners Group going in? Why did they submit the proposal? And then why did they go out with a scorched earth letter? Aside from they knew they were not going
to
get chosen.
Right, and we should get to that in a second, but I mean, obviously, as we've just detailed in past Peltoncasts, it's their competition with Oakview Group, and specifically with Live Nation for live booking.
They just had to do it.
And the fact that they're the incumbent, since they're currently managing Key Arena. Now, that makes the decision to go scorched earth a curious one, because they continue to manage Key Arena right now and for the foreseeable future until the renovation starts. So I don't know what happens with that relationship, but I mean, they were never serious about it. Like, they were more serious than I expected. Like, they spent more money on this than I expected, but their proposal was never serious. The other curious part of this, which I think maybe does have some merit, is that Seattle Partners has actively sought feedback from community leaders, city staff, and members of the city's community advisory council, and in response, we've explored improvements to our proposal. However, consistent with the general lack of active engagement through this evaluation process, the city declined to seek improved terms, refusing requests from us and others to call for a, quote, best and final offer from both bidders. We have seen little indication of the collaborative and iterative process we were told to expect and is typical of such requests for proposals. Now, the actual request for proposal says nothing about this.
Mm-hmm.
It suggests you should have submitted your best and final offer is your first offer. But it is true that it seems like Oakview has been allowed to manipulate things a little bit with their parking garage, and it's possible that, in fact, they did not get kind of the collaboration they were expecting.
Okay.
So, anyways, as you noted, the widespread expectation was that Mayor Ed Murray was going to recommend the Oakview plan anyway, And the press conference has been called for Wednesday morning for the official announcement of this, which I plan to attend.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Get some live PeltonCast coverage there. I don't know if there will be anything of note said at this press conference. But so the other news besides this.
Okay.
The Oakview financials were revealed. That was one of the complaints that AEG and Seattle Partners had in this scorched earth letter withdrawing, is that they felt that it was not a level playing field because their financial information was all there, out there, and Oakview's wasn't, or at least they released it. But subsequently, King 5 got a copy of the Oakview financials. And I got to be honest, maybe I don't know enough to make sense of it. I don't think I learned anything new from it.
Okay.
I mean, there's been people questioning their wherewithal financially to, you know, borrow the funds necessary to fund the renovation without using the public bonding capacity. That, to me, is not a particular concern. As I think about the Oakview proposal, like, we're dealing with MSG. Like, this is a company that has enough money to handle this.
Yes, they'll be able to get it done.
My concern is strictly with how their financing redirects a lot of taxes and things like that back to them, as opposed to those going to the city.
Okay.
Which, you know, I think is what makes the Soto offer a more financially attractive one for the city, in the absence of the consideration of what else has to be done with Key Arena, and possibly a more attractive one even when we factor in Key Arena.
Okay, so what does this mean? Two different questions. What does this mean for the Soto proposal, and what does this mean for the Key Arena proposal going forward?
Them with the AEG withdrawing?
What does the recommendation from the mayor mean?
So that's an interesting question, because ultimately, as we've talked about in the past, the mayor has no say in this. It's really up to the city council to approve this deal and to make the choice effectively between the Soto Arena and the Oakview and Key Arena renovation. You know, whether Ed Murray's influence comes into play here is unclear. I don't know his relationship with the council at this point, especially given that he is a lame duck mayor at this point. The other question is how quickly the council wants to go through this process, or whether they anticipate, you know, a lot of continued negotiations with Oakview to improve this proposal from their standpoint. So by going through the selection process among the two bidders so quickly, I do think that it's possible the mayor's office may have forfeited an opportunity to pit those two bidders against each other.
Uh-huh.
But you still have the competition between Oakview and the Soto Arena.
They don't need the leverage between those two.
They don't necessarily need it, but I don't know if I would have thrown it away either. And we do also have some continued criticism coming in. The Uptown Alliance, which is a community group for the area that is colloquially known as Low
Ann,
including Key Arena, they said in a letter from Debbie Fosto to the mayor's office, after much study and discussion about each proposal's strengths and weaknesses, Uptown Alliance found both proposals lacking in different but fundamental ways and cannot favor one submission over another at this time, which was before AEG pulled out. And specifically on Oakview's proposal, it being arena-focused gives little attention to its integration within Seattle Center and ignoring the community at large, as well as sparse details on the newly formed operating company and its values. And their recommendation was to slow down the process and get more information.
Just be Seattle about it?
Yes. So we'll see if the council does that or not.
So I guess what this means going forward is this mayor's recommendation means basically nothing.
I mean, it may hold some sway with the city council,
it
but
meant
it has
something
no
when
practical
there were two
value.
Proposals, but now that there's one proposal, it means very little.
Yes.
Ultimately, what it comes down to is the city council will vote on a street vacation sometime in August.
Probably September.
Probably sometime in the late summer, early fall.
Yes.
And that will kind of sort the issue.
I mean, it's possible they could take a vote on the Oakview proposal prior to that. I mean, the timetable for that is somewhat less clear.
It's all down to the city council voting between either the street vacation at Soto or voting on this proposal.
Yeah, I mean, and the expectation is council member Rob Johnson discussed on the Seattle Growth podcast that came out last week that we mentioned, is that they will kind of view these proposals in parallel. And, I mean, there's not probably going to be a lot of back and forth with the Soto group because that proposal has been pretty finely tuned at this point, although, mm-hmm. you know, some of the financials of them going private may be an issue. it's really mostly, I think, going to be about vetting this Oakview proposal in the same way that they vetted the Soto proposal back in 2012 when it was initially approved.
So it could mean delaying the vote for the street vacation?
I don't know, but I wouldn't say yes or no on that.
Are there any local people? So on the, was there any progress for the Soto group at this point this week?
Not specifically. Chris Hansen is going to be appearing at the Civic Cocktail on Wednesday night along with Pete Nordstrom and Wally Walker, and that will be airing on Thursday night at 8 p.m. on the Seattle Channel.
What is a Civic Cocktail?
Some sort of get-together where...
Can you go to that?
I think theoretically, yes, but given that it's opposite Game 3 of the NBA Finals, in practice, no.
Okay.
Can the listener go?
Yes.
Probably, yeah.
Okay. So that's with Pete Nordstrom and Chris Hansen.
And Wally Walker.
Are there any Seattle people who are behind this Oakview proposal? Like, that's Pete Nordstrom, a prominent business owner, Wally Walker, who was involved with the Sonics, and also is a business owner in Seattle?
Yeah.
Runs
a small business here.
Are there any local people who are involved with this Oakview group who are kind of notable business people? Or is it kind of all of the Seattle people are for Soto, and this is a national company on the other side? Or an international company, even?
I don't know if I have a good answer for that. I mean, I don't think that they've really tried to, like, make that support public in the same way. So. You also forgot Russell Wilson on the Soto side.
Yes. Basically, we've got the Russell Wilson group and then an international company.
Yes.
Against each other. I mean, it's an interesting thing to consider, and I think that will matter to the council. They're going to be viewing this as, what do they do with Key Arena? Basically, the questions for them are, which proposal is better for the city money-wise? What do they do with Key Arena? And what do their constituents prefer, right?
Yeah.
Which this, you know, people in the Seattle community favoring Soto might be a factor.
Could be, yeah. I mean, I think they're going to... Yeah, if it wasn't for the fact that Key Arena is a city asset that they have to figure out what to do with, I don't think it would be a conversation.
If they could not care about Key Arena, it would be over.
Yes, because in terms of the impact to local taxation, it is clear that the Soto Arena is a much better proposal.
Interesting. Well, anyway, we're down to two.
Yeah. There you go.
You had some very hot takes there.
I sweated a little bit. It was that hot.
Speaking of hot takes,
the Mariners are hot, and so are these takes.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you. Last week, I said they had a window, but I did not expect the Mariners to smash through that window this quickly.
They did.
They've won 8 out of 9, averaging 7.5 runs per game during that span.
Wow.
They're now up to a 20% chance to make the playoffs, which is a good thing. Up to 5th in the MLB in weighted runs created, just 2.5 games out of the wild card.
How about that?
And these teams that they're beating, they're not bad teams.
Yeah.
They're beating division winners in Colorado and the Minnesota Twins. The Devil Rays, who I still call them that.
No.
Who were in the hunt for a wild card spot before they spent one long sleepless weekend in Seattle.
That was too hot a team name take.
And this is everybody doing it for the Mariners. We're talking Gamel, Zunino, Cano, Taylor, fucking Motter. Woo!
Did I catch a nighter?
It feels good right now to watch baseball for the first time in a long time.
And it seems like the Mariners are starting to move towards getting healthier. Rehab start for Felix Hernandez at AAA Tacoma on Tuesday.
Not great.
It didn't go well?
No.
Well, yeah. He might not be that good anymore. That's the coldest of possible.
Look, we got Ben Gamel. We're okay.
Mitch Haniger also down there in Tacoma rehabbing.
Much better.
Yeah. Hisashi Iwakuma threw 2 simulated innings on Sunday. And those probably went reasonably well.
Did not do good. Oh, no. Got roughed up in the simulated innings.
It was a poor simulation.
It's okay. They've got some guy named Guvia Cavilio, somebody like that.
Okay.
Things are okay.
Also, an interesting report on Tuesday from MLB Network's John Morosi since confirmed by many other sources, that the Mariners are close to an extension.
It's signed. It's done.
Oh, it's done?
It's done.
All right. That first reported by him. And do we have the terms on that officially?
I don't know about officially, but I saw 5 years, $70 million.
Yeah, that was reported by Hector Gomez of Deportivo Z100 in the Dominican Republic, which is the first time we have ever cited Deportivo Z100.
Speak for yourself. This is a steal of a deal, though.
Is it?
I mean, you don't think so?
I really don't. That I come to this part of the podcast to know what to think about the Mariners. I don't come in with thoughts.
If Gene Segura would have hit free agency, he's getting paid $20 million a year. With the way that he's hitting, he's one of the best hitters in the American League at this point, and plays an important position, and plays good defense. I mean, this was a no-brainer for the Mariners, and you look at it, they have so many old players on this roster and old stars that locking up one of their younger players is basically a must-do for the Mariners.
Okay.
So John Segura could be, you know, Felix will be gone, Iwakuma will be gone, Cano could be gone, Cruz could be gone in 5 years. But John Segura will be there and at a reasonable price.
Okay.
But it's baseball. He could fall. His whole career could end.
Do we know how old
he could just get injured and fall off a cliff?
Do we know how old he'll be at the end of the contract? Because I can't seem to bring up baseballreference.com.
He will be 32 years old.
Okay. So this takes him through his late prime, I guess.
This is his prime right now. Baseball players' prime is like 27 through 29.
I suppose it's moved back a little bit.
I mean, they have him locked up for his prime. This is a great signing. I mean, it really, all things considered, it looks like a great trade for the Mariners, too.
Yeah.
Because they still control Mitch Haniger all the way through his arbitration years. And when he's winning 2 and 3 MVPs during that time period, you're going to say, we're not going to remember anything about Taijuan Walker.
Okay. Anything else on the Mariners?
Feeling good.
All right. That was a hot take this week. Into the roundup portion this week, we start with the Seattle Sounders, who played 2 matches last week, as we noted, without Clint Dempsey and Jordan Morris. And their absence, I would say, was keenly felt in a 3-0 loss at Columbus on Wednesday. That one, like, got out of hand pretty quickly.
Yeah, I turned it on. I stopped watching. But I turned it off as quickly as I turned off those NBA games.
But on Sunday, back home, the Sounders got a 1-0 victory against the Houston Dynamo, with the winning goal coming from Will Bruin, who came back from a dislocated elbow.
Cheers to Will Bruin.
To score against his former team. A great moment for him.
Huge.
And yeah, a huge 3 points. The Sounders get back on the right side of the red line into the playoffs if the season ended today. Never mind that the Galaxy are 1 point behind them with 2 games in hand.
Doesn't matter.
But still, we said last week...
All that matters is if the season ended today.
We said last week, going into that week, so shorthanded, that the Sounders, you know, if they could get 2 points, it would be a great week. For them to get 3, you know, was outstanding.
Yes. Probably didn't want to lose as badly as they did lose to Columbus, but...
Although, interestingly, the expected goals on that game, it was only like, you know, goal and a half given up. So it was much closer than the final score indicated. Sounders remain second in the MLS in expected goal differential on American Soccer Analysis, despite having been outscored on the season on the actual score sheet.
And we're going to cling to that all year.
We are.
It'll be our supporter's shield.
Yes. That's what the Sounders are going for at this point.
Some years we say that the supporter shield is all that matters. Some years we say that the playoffs are all that matters. This year we say that the expected goals are all that matters.
Well, we could also say that the U.S. Open Cup is all that matters. And though the Sounders have this weekend off with the international break and several more players going on international duty for their national teams, on Tuesday they will host Portland, the hated rival Portland Timbers, in the U.S. Open Cup. And you were there the last time the Sounders hosted the Timbers in the Open Cup. And the season fell apart in one game.
That was it.
Yeah.
It took them a year and a half to recover from that one game.
Clint Dempsey tearing up the referee's little book where he writes down who's been carded and such.
Between that and Obafemi Martins getting injured in that game, it was a train wreck.
Yeah, it was really bad.
Really hoping that this one goes quite a bit better than that.
I mean... Odds are, based on regression to the mean, it will have to go better than
based
that.
Based on regression to the mean, Obafemi Martins won't get injured and Clint Dempsey won't be suspended for 8 games.
Yes. The Sounders will make regression to the mean work for them here.
You have a very loose definition of regression to the mean.
I have. No, that's a clear definition of regression to the mean.
Okay.
On the Seattle Storm front, pun intended there, they lost 177 Saturday against Minnesota in the showdown of a couple of the top 2 teams in the WNBA season, it turned out that one was substantially better than the other.
Okay.
As you probably might have guessed from the fact that the Lynx have been one of the league's best teams for many years, and the Storm are still up and coming in that regard. But back on track, getting their first road win of the season on Tuesday night in San Antonio against Kelsey Plum and the Stars.
Yeah, can we get a Kelsey Plum update?
So she started the last two games at point guard to figure out what to do with her and Mariah Jefferson, who are both point guards and haven't really played much together or effectively together so far. She's looked somewhat better. She's cut down on the turnovers. Those haven't been as much of an issue. She's still not shooting the ball particularly well. She was 2 of 8 in this game with 6 points. But the Storm and Stars were even in the 25 minutes she played. Stars were outscored by 9 in the 15 minutes she spent on the bench.
Okay.
Despite the fact that Mariah Jefferson led a late comeback with Plum watching from the bench. But a nice win here for the Storm to kick off a 3-game road trip. They play at Indiana and New York coming up on this trip. Two teams that they beat at home, Indiana twice earlier this season. And I think a pretty good chance for them to get a split coming on this road trip, and then they will be back home to face Atlanta on Tuesday. So Storm at 5-2 now on the young season.
Not bad.
UW Sports. We pour a little out for the UW softball team.
Still, it was a good run.
It was a great run. Beat Oregon in their opening game in the
Women's
College
really
World Series. Yeah.
They beat both of the Pac-12 teams they played.
Single most important thing. Then subsequently lost to the eventual champions, Oklahoma, in the quarterfinal round, I guess.
Did Oklahoma win? They've won it all?
Oklahoma ended up winning it all.
Wow.
I mean, can we talk about...
They played in their home.
How unfair is this? They've now won, I think, 3 of the last 5.
Is it always played there?
Yes.
Are you kidding
me? It's been played there, like, basically every year since it started.
It's really not a neutral site.
No, not even a remote line.
It's absurd.
Yeah, it's a huge unfair advantage for them.
Well, because you said whomever won the game against the UW versus Oregon game would have a good chance of advancing because they're playing a lower seed. But yeah, you didn't take into account that it was played in that lower seed's home stadium.
And like, if you looked at the Sankaran rankings, like UW is better than Oklahoma, but it's a small difference, much smaller than home field advantage would
yes.
be. So, yeah, Oklahoma beat Florida in 17 innings in game one of the WCWS final championship series. And then won game two tonight to sweep the series. Florida eventually knocked the Huskies out of the tournament because of a weird thing where you switched to the opposite side of the bracket. This was all very new to us. I knew most of the bracket, but that I did not understand.
Who did you think they were playing?
I thought they were going to end up playing Oregon again.
Okay.
But instead they faced UCLA in one game to get to the semifinals against Florida, but then they would have had to beat Florida twice in one day.
It wasn't happening.
No, that was not realistic.
Florida was the number one team in the country.
Yeah. Yeah. They avoided a shutout, so that was nice.
Florida was a much better team.
Florida and Oklahoma were clearly the two best teams. Just two seniors on the roster, shortstop Ellie Aguilar and left fielder Casey Stengel, both of whom were all Pac-12 first team picks. Also, the all Pac-12 first team, much like in basketball, it's got like 25 players on it. They just put everyone on the first team. But no, both of them had excellent senior years, so they will definitely be missed.
Ale Aguilar carried them through. I mean, won the game against UCLA for them and pretty much also won the game against Oregon.
Yeah.
She kind of carried the team offensively through the entire Women's College World Series.
But you've still got a pretty young roster. Taranovello coming back on the mound. I think a good chance for the Huskies to get back to the Women's College World Series next year.
Lose
to Oklahoma again.
That is ridiculous.
They play
every single year there. I didn't realize that they don't rotate.
They don't.
That's insane.
It's also a huge advantage for Creighton in the baseball College World Series.
Because they play both there.
No, they play in Omaha.
Oh, they play in Omaha for baseball. Okay.
Yeah.
But Nebraska's not good at baseball.
I think Creighton is actually in Omaha. Nebraska is technically in Lincoln, so it's slightly less of an advantage.
I think people can travel. They're like the adjacent cities. Anyway, it was fun to watch. I think every year
it was a lot of fun to watch. I ended up watching a shocking amount of Women's College World Series, including some of the other games.
Me too.
I was just in my hotel a lot of the time.
Leave the TV on and Women's College World Series is on.
It's so much better than college basketball.
Oh my, it's not even close. It really isn't even close. Like, watching, it's an enjoyable thing to watch. Whereas, there are some things that are not enjoyable to watch about the Women's College World Series, which is the prevalence of bunting Oh my God, there's so much bunting that happens.
Showing bunt. I don't get that.
It's constant. It's like Moneyball never happened for women's softball.
Well, I mean, I think that some of the run expectancies are much different in softball than they are in Major League Baseball.
So it's like the Huskies in the game against UCLA were wasting outs constantly.
Well, they're base running. They were
stealing.
That was the Oklahoma game. They were
the Oklahoma game. They couldn't get anybody on base.
Yeah, it was the UCLA game where they kept running into outs on the
base
pass. Yes.
Oh, it was so hard to watch. I mean, there were a lot of mental mistakes during the series. But eventually, I mean, they basically lost to two teams who Oklahoma was playing at home. Florida was clearly better.
Yeah.
And I think that they won the games that they should have won, despite the fact that their bats really couldn't do much of anything through any of the games in the tournament.
No. Can I make a Peltoncast resolution?
Oh, wow.
We got to go to a softball game next
year. Yeah, we got to go to a softball game.
It's ridiculous we haven't been, other than the time we watched from Husky Stadium during the spring game.
Yeah. Looking over from Husky Stadium.
Which was a good time. Probably more exciting than the spring game.
No, I mean, I'm not making a resolution to go to a college basketball game.
No.
I might make a resolution to not go to one. Which, speaking of which.
Well, okay, we'll skip ahead to that. Nzaia Carter, better known as the nephew of Jay-Z.
Oh.
Making a visit to UW last weekend. So he's officially a 2017 recruit, on track to graduate this year, but considering taking a prep school year and reclassifying to 2018. He mentioned that in an interview with Bleacher Report's David Gardner. Also said in that, I like Washington too, because I know Coach Hopkins.
Two along with whom?
There was a handful of other teams. He was originally committed to Dayton.
Okay.
He reopened his recruiting when Archie Miller went to Indiana. Indiana is one of the teams that are on the table. There's a handful of others. But UW in the mix, certainly. Carter is a 6'6 wing who has gotten a lot of attention lately for in the Nike EYBL competition, dunking on Bull Bull.
Okay.
Who's the son of Manute and a top prospect.
He was like, I don't just want to give you Manute Bull Jr. You're Bull Bull.
And Marvin Bagley, who is the top prospect in the 2018 class.
Really? And he threw down on both of them?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that'll be interesting to watch because, I mean, like if Jay-Z were at UW games, that would be pretty awesome.
Can you imagine that?
All of a sudden,
like you're wearing purple for UW would be very cool.
It would.
If Ho was there wearing purple for UW?
Oh, yeah. That'd be great. Also on Husky Sports, men's crew wins the Jim Ten Eyck Memorial Trophy, is the overall points champion at the Intercollegiate Rowing Association National Championship at Lake Natoma in California, is the overall points champion for the 10th time in the last 11 years, losing only last year, 2016. However, they did not win the big prize, which is the Men's Varsity 8, finishing second to Yale by 0.069 seconds, which is the time it takes me to, I don't know, but not very long. Men's crew did win the second.
Is Yale is our hated rivals?
I suppose so.
Okay.
I mean, probably the West Coast schools are more of our hated rivals, but Yale apparently has done some strong recruiting lately in the rowing world. The UW did win the second and third varsity eights in the varsity four competition.
They're actually recruiting in
yeah,
really.
That's a thing.
And crew.
Yeah.
Why did they not think to do that for the previous like 200 years?
Well, I mean, I mean, they can't offer scholarships, so I don't know how exactly they're doing that, but
okay.
Like apparently, I guess they've been doing a better job of it. It's like, you know, why didn't UW think to recruit better players under Bob Bender? Like, I'm sure they considered it. They just couldn't do it.
Okay, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's just what I read on UWDogPound.com. I don't know that much. I don't have that much insight into crew recruiting.
Wait, why they didn't recruit better players under Bob Bender? Because Tom McCullough.
Yeah.
Look, shouts to Deion Ludon.
Shouts to Deion Ludon. Donald Watts. But Jason Terry remains the one who got away. Shall we wrap things up here by talking about the Seahawks?
I don't know. That was too much of a sigh. I want to do half that sigh.
I think it was an appropriate level of sigh. The Seahawks in the crosshairs this week, after declining to sign Colin Kaepernick and instead signing Austin Davis to a one-year contract for the minimum with a $50,000 signing bonus and a $30,000 roster bonus if he makes the roster. Your thoughts?
I guess I would have liked them to have signed Colin Kaepernick. I think that Colin Kaepernick would be a more effective backup than Austin Davis.
I mean, that's an unquestioned fact.
But at the same time, I don't like the idea of a team being in the crosshairs, I'm quoting that, for not signing a player.
I mean, really, the Seahawks' biggest mistake was showing interest in Colin Kaepernick. If they had just been in the background, like, no one would have said anything. But by showing that they valued Colin Kaepernick enough to bring him in for a visit, then they put themselves in position to be criticized.
I just, the whole Colin Kaepernick story has been very strange to me from the very beginning. I don't know if I necessarily agree that he's being blacklisted. I think there are just a lot of teams who don't understand, who don't recognize the value that Colin Kaepernick could bring to them. Basically, there are a lot of teams who are shooting for things that are much bigger risks, right? They're making much riskier plays. Like, okay, take fantasy football, right? Like, for me, a wide receiver, like, I don't know, some replacement level wide receiver, like an agent, Victor Cruz for like the last 5 years or something.
Right.
Somebody who...
Pierre Garçon is the guy who was always on my roster and I feel like falls into this.
It's somebody who I would never draft them, even though they likely will put up more points than most of the players that I would draft. I'm always taking much riskier players.
Yes.
And this might be a way of, I'm just explaining away the inherent like conservatism of NFL general managers, etc. But I feel like most teams are looking at it and saying, we want this high-risk option, whether it be a young quarterback or whatever, rather than a quarterback who most likely, best-case scenario for a bad team, for a team that he could be a starting quarterback on, wouldn't make them a playoff team.
Yeah.
And I think that's really... For the Seahawks, what it means is I do believe that they thought that he was a starting caliber quarterback. I think that maybe they were a little bit concerned about the idea of what it would signify by bringing in Colin Kaepernick, and it could hypothetically raise some issues. Like, Pete Carroll might have looked at the situation and said, this could create issues at some point. It's not worth it. A backup quarterback is not worth it.
In terms of the political aspect, or in terms of
the locker room
controversy,
in terms of the locker room, in terms of the political aspect, in terms of everything,
I disagree with you completely on the political aspect. I think it is a much bigger problem for them politically to not sign Colin Kaepernick than it is for them to sign
Colin Kaepernick. When we get to August, nobody's going to be talking about Colin Kaepernick unless Russell Wilson gets hurt, and Colin Kaepernick might still be out there.
True. But I'm saying, like, if in the event the Seahawks signed Colin Kaepernick, the city of Seattle as a whole would like that move.
I don't know if I agree with that.
I'm very strong in my belief about that.
I think in general, it's a backup quarterback. It doesn't matter.
This might matter.
This is the same as I said last week. This is off-season talk, because it is. It's a player that they didn't sign.
It is, I mean, which a lot of players they didn't sign.
A backup quarterback. That's really what this is at its most basic level.
But I don't buy that it has anything to do with, you know, the political implications of him kneeling. I don't think that factored into
Seahawks' decision. I don't know if I think that either. But
you just said you thought that.
Well, no, it's not about the political implications of that. It's about the attention that it draws.
See, at this point, you know what? You know what's a better attention for this? You know what's a worse attention than Colin Kaepernick kneeling?
What?
Richard Sherman yelling at his teammates and hating Russell Wilson. Like,
that's but old news. Everybody said old news.
It could get brought back very easily. I would say...
But that's a reason not to bring in Colin Kaepernick, is what I'm saying.
No, the things that Kaepernick is quote-unquote distracting from are, like, worse things for the Seahawks.
I guess so. I could just see it exacerbating certain issues. Where it's like, it's a backup quarterback. It's not important enough to undo the balance that you have.
You were very pro-signing Kaepernick last
week. I'm still pro-signing Colin Kaepernick, but if they see it as a situation where it could undo the balance for the team in the locker room, I'm pro-signing Colin Kaepernick from a football standpoint, and I bet you if you talk to Pete Carroll, he would probably agree with that also. I think that everybody, including the Seahawks, agree that Colin Kaepernick is a better football player than Austin Davis.
Yes.
But they clearly, everything else that has to do with Colin Kaepernick outweighs him being better than Austin Davis, because really, him being better than Austin Davis is not that big of a deal.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. You forced me into taking a different position here than I expected to take. I mean, I think fundamentally they were concerned that whether he would be happy in the starting job.
Yes.
I mean, that's the, to me, the only logical explanation for why you would bring him in, talk to him, and then not sign him.
I mean, could we just don't? It's all speculation.
Especially given the report from Mike Freeman at Bleacher Report that money was not a factor. Although surely Kaepernick would have expected more than the minimum that Davis.
Exactly.
Got.
That's another thought. Like, money wasn't a factor, which means they talked to him about money, and it was probably a bigger number than they were offering Austin Davis. But it still is a factor.
Yeah, I mean, just tough, because it's tough to parse.
They and Colin Kaepernick were willing to meet at a number in this hypothetical world that they wanted to sign Colin Kaepernick doesn't mean that that number was the minimum.
Right. It's so, probably a couple million at least, I would expect.
It's still a factor. It's still probably three, maybe four times what Austin Davis is making.
So Austin Davis started 8 games in 2014 for the St. Louis Rams, including beating the Seahawks, God. As you'll recall. I mean, really, Tavon Austin beat the Seahawks, or was their special teams coordinator's name again?
John Fossil.
Yes. He beat the Seahawks in that game. Davis that season completed 63% of his attempts for 7.0 yards per attempt, which is actually not all that bad.
My other hot take is I don't think Austin Davis is that bad.
That is shockingly good, but he did have 9 interceptions on 284 attempts, which is not good. Not good at all.
Who has been a quarterback who's played good for St. Louis / LA? Kurt Warner.
Yes. It's not Jared Goff. I know that much. If you compare directly, that, well, actually, you know what the answer is?
Oh, no. What is it?
Speaking of that game, it's Johnny Hecker. Johnny Hecker. 2 of 2 for 37 yards that season. 118.7 QB rating. That season, Sean Hill was the other quarterback who split starts with Austin Davis. He also completed 63% of his passes for 7.2 yards per attempt. These are all shockingly good.
I know. I'd take any of these guys as a backup quarterback.
Identical interception rate, but a slightly lower QBR for reasons that I cannot entirely divine. Davis did get sacked a ton. So that, you know, that shouldn't be an issue, though, if he has to play behind the
defensive line. They'll be comfortable with it. They're used to quarterbacks who get sacked a ton.
Yeah.
It's part of the offense. Yeah, no, I mean, I like the Austin Davis signing. I'm pro Austin Davis also. Don't get me wrong. I would have preferred Colin Kaepernick as, from a football standpoint. But I also like Austin Davis because I feel a lot more comfortable with the idea of Austin Davis being the quarterback than I do with Trevon Boykin.
I was expecting not to think that, but looking at his statistics, I guess I probably should think that.
When also he has significant starting experience.
I don't know if I would go so far as to say significant, but he has some.
That's 8 games versus 0 games.
He actually started 2 in 2015 with Cleveland. There he, let's see here, had 5.8 yards per attempt.
And also, most signings that the Seahawks make, I will predict that they're going to get cut.
That's a good prediction.
You want me to go through them? Luke Jokel, gone. Eddie Lacy, gone. Anyway, I don't think that Austin Davis will be cut. I think he will be the backup quarterback, and I think Trevon Boykin will either be on the practice squad or gone.
Did you see Mike Sando's, like, other teams do off-season grades for their team, for the teams?
No, what do you mean?
So like, he talked to other front offices about the off-seasons of, the, in this case, the Seahawks. And at least one person he talked to said that their team was in on Luke Jokel.
Yes, there was I did see that.
So they graded the Seahawks offseason a B, I believe, collectively.
Well, that's good.
So there you go.
Because that matters.
It does. It definitely does.
They graded the offseason as disappointed they didn't sign Colin Kaepernick.
Speaking of offseason talk, that is pretty much the literal definition of offseason yes. talk. Is this a part of the podcast where we talk about hydro racing?
Oh, yeah. It absolutely it is.
Big week in the unlimited hydroplane racing world. They had the spring testing in the Tri-Cities last weekend. We should have gotten our uncle... special guest Uncle Bob on
still
the podcast.
Time to call in Uncle Bob. It's only midnight. He has to be awake, right?
He is here. He is here, but he went out to the testing and reported he was excited to see the vintage pay and pack, I believe, testing over the weekend. But then also JW Myers taking over the cockpit of the Elam Plus next season. So there
he was excited about testing of a hydroplane that won't actually race.
Yes.
Man, we need to get a younger hydroplane reporter.
I mean, he's only our Tri-Cities hydroplane correspondent. I'm the hydroplane correspondent in Seattle. Naturally.
You've got some more youthful takes, some pro-tide and frosted flakes.
Yes.
Yes.
Those memories.
What was the Kellogg's boat called? What was it?
Kellogg's Frosted Flakes.
Okay.
Yeah. which was Miss Madison, of course.
Okay, so what were you saying about J.W. Myers?
He'll take over the cockpit of the Elam this season.
And what was he driving previously?
That's Burien native J.W. Myers. Well,
really?
He had been out of the driving game for a little bit.
Oh. There,
so getting back into
the... But who was driving the Elam previously?
I honestly can't remember.
We're going to have to get Bob on the phone here.
It's been a while. I don't think they raced last year.
Elam didn't race last year?
I don't think so. Maybe they did. No, I must be wrong about it. They definitely did last year.
Is John Theoret, is he driving this year?
Driving this year. Yeah, that's who it was.
Wow. So maybe I'm the hydroplane.
You are the hydroplane correspondent at this point. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, that's great to hear. I didn't know that there was testing that happened in the Tri-Cities. When does the hydroplane season start?
4th of July weekend, we'll have the regatta in Madison, but there will only be four boats at it this year, a different
four boats.
Because
it's almost as if it's a dying sport.
It's not great.
It's even less teams than the WNBA.
Yes, that is unequivocally true. But Madison could not afford the fee for a full fleet of boats, so they'll just have four this year.
Wow.
So. There you go. We'll have all the updates as the season starts. And
I'm so excited. Are you going to Tri-Cities Water Follies?
Are you going, apparently?
I don't know. I think so.
I mean, I'm definitely going.
Yeah, I mean, I can't wait for the live Peldoncast from Water Follies.
Oh, that should be a good one.
Wait, what's the bar there? Jack's?
Jack's Sons.
That's where we should do our live event. For all of our listeners in the Tri-Cities.
That wasn't the place we went to the one time.
The Town Crier. Live podcast from the Town Crier.
I really hope that we have a listener from the Tri-Cities who's getting these references. It would be so amazing.
That's where it's going
to
be.
We have to make our cousin listen to this. All right, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.